to another edition of the Rambling Through Albion podcast. Chris here.
Ines here too.
Yep, we've had another busy week and we're here to bring you up to date with the cultural exchanges we've had here in London. Now, two of the events which we'll highlight later in the podcast, the Sherlock Holmes exhibition at the Museum of London and the Clipper Round the World race, have a way to go before they reach their conclusions. And although our roundup begins with an overview of a display which is now finished, we can at least use it to extol the virtues of the British Museum.
Right, it's a fantastic museum, and I must say, if you are interested in history, art, or even architecture, depending on your level of interest, you could lose yourself in there for a couple of hours or even weeks or months.
Indeed, the museum itself is a national treasure. Now, I just want to highlight at this stage that the man behind the museum, Sir Hans Sloane, was from Ireland.
I didn't know that.
Well, you should have guessed, because let's face it, all the best things come from Ireland, especially from Killalea in County Down, which is where Sir Hans was born. We visited there last year, and hey, and you will well know that it's also the birthplace of Sir David Healy, who scored the winning goal against England in 2005 and a hat-trick against Spain in 2006.
Oh dear, why do you always go on about that?
I mean, they're two of the greatest sporting moments in history, so why wouldn't I? But anyway, Sir Hans was a good lad. He worked as a physician. I think he was actually personal doctor to Queen Anne and to Kings George I and II. He'd done a bit of travelling, picked up a few things along the way. In fact, he brought drinking chocolate to the British Isles. And by the time he died in 1753, he'd amassed a collection of over 71,000 objects, which he left to the nation in his will. In return, he'd asked for £20,000 to be given to his surviving family, and again, typical of an Irishman, he'd totally undervalued what his collection was worth and sold his family short. Anyhow, the goods were eventually housed in a building in Bloomsbury and the British Museum was born.
It's very interesting. Anyway, Sloane is quite a familiar name. Where have I heard it before?
Well, so highly thought of was old Hansy that they named a load of streets and gardens in London after him, including Sloane Square, which now houses a tube station of the same name. He was also president of both the Royal Society and the College of Physicians, and he was a founding governor of the Foundling Hospital, which was the first national institution to care for abandoned children. He managed to fit a lot into life, although to be fair, and quite remarkably, he did live until he was 92 years old, at a time when life expectancy was 40. Scurvy and smallpox were pretty bad back then.
Sounds like we have a lot to thank him for.
Indeed, Sloane planted those seeds many years ago, and there are now an estimated 6 million visitors to the British Museum every year. Ine, you're an architect. What can you tell us about the centrepiece of the British Museum, the Grand Court?
Well, originally it was a courtyard garden. Then a circular reading room was built there in the mid-19th century, and the courtyard was closed to the public. However, it was redesigned in 1997 by Sir Norman Foster, one of the most famous modern British architects, and opened in 2000 by the Queen. The reading room remains in the centre, but this is still closed to the public.
Yeah, that's a real pity. My dad visited there years ago and told me it was magnificent, so I'm quite sad that I haven't got to see it yet, but hopefully sometime in the future. As we said before, it's not like there's nothing else to see there. And throughout the day, there are loads of free mini tours of certain rooms available, and I always find these to make the visit much more enjoyable, because the guides can provide more in-depth explanation of the artifacts and maybe little anecdotes about them, and it really does add value to a trip. So just check the museum's website in advance of your visit, or even just pitch up and check the What's On boards, which can be found in the Great Court. I have to admit that I can be slightly overwhelmed by these huge museums, and my attention can start to wander fairly quickly. So I do prefer to go when there's an exhibition running, which I think might be quite interesting. I'd been aware that the British Museum was hosting a display called Witches and Wicked Bodies, and thought that sounded worth a look. For which I guess I have to thank Roald Dahl. Children of the 80s and their parents indeed will know what I'm talking about here. We went there last Friday night, The museum does open later on Fridays until 8:30 p.m. so it is perfect for a cheap post-work visit. And we did spend about an hour there looking at a load of engravings, etchings, woodcuts and paintings depicting witches and demonology dating from the 15th to 19th century. And the exhibition explained how myths surrounding witches had spread down through the ages. What did you think of the exhibition, Inhe?
Overall, I liked it. Although most works are monochrome, you could see the delicate details. I also saw work by famous artists such as Durer, Goya, Delacroix, Burne Jones and Dante Gabriel Rossetti. But it did seem a bit misogynistic.
Well, I think they're very much a product of their time, and it is hard to imagine that anyone could have believed that there were such things as witches, and actually quite a lot of innocent people died because of such ideas. But there were a few works that I did quite like, examples which we'll add photos of on our website include The Tribulations of St. Anthony and another called Bewitched Groom by Hans Baldung, a German artist. I also like the examples of British political satire, which dated back to the 18th century. It wasn't necessarily that the artwork itself was fantastic, and compared to some of the other works on display, it wasn't, but it did at least show that our history of free speech dates back quite a few hundred years. I'm sorry that this exhibition is now closed and our recommendation therefore counts for nothing, but there is always enough to satisfy interest at the British Museum, and it's one of those places that you must see if you are visiting London. Do plan ahead, however, especially if you're short of time, because if you don't head straight for the section that you're interested in, you could lose quite a lot of hours in there. Okay, let's move on to an exhibition which still has a bit of time to run.
The Museum of London is running an event called Sherlock Holmes, The Man Who Never Lived and Will Never Die. We went along last Saturday to check it out.
Yeah, we're both big fans of the new modern BBC interpretation of Sherlock, aren't we, Anne?
Yeah, although you weren't sure about it at first.
That's right. I mean, I think I've read all the Sherlock Holmes stories and loved the old black and white Basil Rathbone movies. So when I heard that the BBC was going to produce a version set in 21st century London, I was quite sceptical. However, I think it's a great example of what's good about the UK these days. We might look to our past for inspiration, but actually we're more than able to use our creativity to captivate new audiences. I didn't really know what to expect from this exhibition. You know, how could the museum produce a display about someone who, as the title suggests, never existed? Sherlock, Watson or Inspector Lestrade had any relics to leave behind. So what would be on show, and how would the experience differ to that on offer at the Sherlock Holmes Museum in Baker Street that's been operating since 1989?
Well, the exhibition was broken down into three sections. The first focused on the author's inspirations and the early publication of the Holmes stories. The second gave visitors an idea of what London was like in Victoria times, when Sherlock would originally have been pounding the pavement. And the third features an array of props and costumes from various TV shows and movies.
It might sound strange, but from the reading that I've done, it seems that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle didn't appear to be Sherlock Holmes' biggest fan. And despite knowing that, I still found the most interesting aspect of the first section to be an old video from 1927, I think, of Doyle revealing why he wrote the stories in the first place, why he felt obliged to keep going with them, even though he wanted to write what he felt were much more serious novels. I don't want to give too much away, but if Doyle's claims are true, one could easily say that he revolutionised crime fiction, and his influence clearly extends far and wide. I couldn't tell by the time of the interview, which was only 3 years before he died, whether he'd reconciled himself to the fact that his contribution to the world of literature would be remembered for his Sherlock Holmes stories. Certainly he admitted that he'd prospered as a result, and he seemed to have a cheeky smile on his face when recalling that he felt forced to continue writing the tales despite his own feelings of indifference. You'll also see some fascinating artifacts in the first section of the exhibition, including an early draft of a story which reveals the names which Doyle had considered for the protagonists, specifically Sherrinford Holmes and his sidekick Ormond Sacker. You'll also get to see some original artwork by Sidney Paget, whose illustrations of Holmes for the Strand magazine have well and truly stood the test of time. Moving on, and as you would perhaps expect from an event hosted by the Museum of London, the second part of the exhibition shows the capital as it was when the Holmes stories were set, specifically during the latter years of Queen Victoria's reign and up until the start of World War I. There are old photographs of many famous London landmarks at the end of the 19th century, most but not all of them still standing, of course. There are present-day time-lapse videos inspired by journeys undertaken by Holmes and Watson during several of the stories, and various old maps of London, including one which charts the economic prosperity, or lack thereof, of an area's inhabitants, and also some wonderful paintings by the likes of Monet and Turner. This section of the exhibition also reminded me a bit of the Titanic Museum in Belfast, which takes advantage of the overarching subject matter to reveal what the city was like at the time of its construction. I found that to be fairly informative, and for anyone who wants a glimpse at Victorian Britain, this part of the Holmes exhibition should provide similar levels of interest. The final section, as I said earlier, houses some props and costumes from Holmes's various silver and smoke screen incarnations, including the old deerstalker hat, violins, and the greatcoat worn by Benedict Cumberbatch in the latest BBC series. This section also highlights Holmes's skills of deduction, his ability to disguise himself, and his drug habit. It is, again, all fairly interesting. So how does it differ to the museum in Baker Street? Well, it's been a few years since we visited, and things could have changed since then, but my abiding memory, and what I believe to be its unique selling point, was that it did a magnificent job of showing what life would have been like within the walls of an old Victorian home. It had the narrow staircases winding up several flights of stairs, the open fires, the creaky floorboards, pokey bedrooms, and the old kitchen and tableware. I had thought that the two wouldn't be able to live side by side, but actually there are clear differences between the Baker Street Museum and the Holmes exhibition at the Museum of London, and I guess if you're a real Sherlock Holmes fan, you might actually take both of them in.
Was there anything you didn't like about the exhibition?
There wasn't anything that I didn't like per se, but I really think they could have made more of Holmes's popularity overseas. There weren't, as far as I could see at least, any references to the Soviet Sherlock Holmes films, which actually earned the main actor Vasily Levonov an honorary award from the Queen, or the 2013 Russian TV series, although I haven't seen it or heard great things about it. There was a Chinese poster promoting one of the Guy Ritchie, Robert Downey Jr. Jude Law films. The museum could really have played up the Sherlock fever gripping China by adding something about our Prime Minister being grilled on when the next BBC series would be produced when he visited the country a couple of years ago.
What's the story there?
He signed up to the Chinese version of Twitter, I think that's called Weibo, in order to take questions from the Chinese public, and quite a few of those, instead of focusing on international politics and diplomacy, were focused on the gaps between series of Sherlock, and told them to get onto the BBC and tell them to speed up their production. Now, to be fair to David Cameron, he did explain that he had little to no sway over the BBC. Anyway, those minor gripes don't detract from what is a fun exhibition. It's running until the 12th of April, so there's still plenty of time to go and see it if you're so inclined. Have a look at the Museum of London's website for some associated special events, such as fancy dress film nights, lectures, walking tours, and even the opportunity to spend Valentine's Day / night in the museum. The website also has a brilliant Sherlock Holmes blog, which includes excerpts from BBC radio productions of the stories down through the years. It's a really nice accompaniment to the exhibition. Let's move outside for the final part of this show. We were at a bit of a loss for something to do last Sunday afternoon. It's noticeable that there are less fun outdoor events scheduled during the winter months here. We found something that caught our attention down at St. Catherine's Dock, near the Tower of London.
Yeah, there was a clipper boat which had taken part in an around the world race last year, and they were trying to get people to sign up for this year's event.
Yeah, that's right. Ordinary people just like you and me. Apparently you don't need any previous sailing experience to take part in this race, something which I find equally intriguing and terrifying. We managed to speak to Matt, who's competing in the race for the first time, about what he thinks is going to lie in store for him and the other crews.
Well, it's the only amateur around the world yacht race, so it's the equivalent, I guess, of what the professionals do, but we're all amateur sailors. So there's going to be about 12 boats sailing all the way around for the next 11 months when we set off in August. And it's just a big set-piece event. Lots of people involved, lots of fun, lots of weather ahead. And luckily we get to go to some pretty cool places as well. So I think it's going to be quite an interesting adventure.
An interesting adventure? I think he's underselling it. It sounds amazing, but quite scary. Tell us, where are they going?
Well, as Matt says, they set off in August from the south of England. I think their first stop is in France, and then they head down to Brazil. Now, that's one of the longest legs of the journey, and they expect to be at sea for over 30 days. From Brazil, they go to South Africa, then Australia, through Indonesia, I think, up to China, and then all the way across the Pacific, and that is the longest leg, at about 9,000 kilometres. And again, they expect to be on the open waters for about 30 days then. The boats then go from San Francisco to New York the long way round through Central America. And from New York, they make the crossing to Northern Ireland. Obviously, that's going to be the best part of the trip. From Londonderry, they go down to Holland and then north again to finish in London. And the whole race will take about 11 months in total.
Wow, that's amazing. But how can you do that if you're not a professional sailor?
Well, each of the 12 boats will be captained by an experienced professional, thankfully. And lots of others who take part do actually have some sailing experience. And you don't have to do the whole thing. You can just do one or two legs. That's particularly handy if you can't take the whole year off work. But I think you need to know what you're getting into. And one of the other crew members told us that there is an interview process to weed out those people who think it's going to be a nice, lovely round-the-world cruise and the people who don't appreciate that it's going to be quite hard work and quite hairy going at times. Matt explained to us what happens, though, if you get through that vetting process and undertake the training programme.
You live on the boat for the week of your training and the whole time is just kind of learning, watching, taking it all on board and then doing, because that's the best way to learn. And then by the last week, hopefully we'll be with our teams and we'll be doing a bit more tactics and thinking how we can beat the rest of the fleet, because after all it is a race and we all want to be with the champagne at the end.
Well, good luck to them. I could never do it. I was in the onboard shower.
Yeah, well, we were able to get down under the boat and below deck. And it is cramped down there. I mean, the kitchen is tiny. I've no idea how they cater for about 20 people from that kitchen. And yeah, the toilet slash shower, that did not look good. So I just imagine that there's going to be loads of really smelly people on board after a month at sea. But as Matt says, this will instill a great sense of camaraderie, and I think one that will exist long after the event is finished.
There's a lot of people who've never been on a boat before, and there's people who've raced across oceans, and I think that's the pleasure. You've got such a mix of people on board and such a mix of countries, and I think the people are going to be the thing that makes it, and they're the people we'll still be friends with years from now. Even just today, there's people from previous races just coming down just to chat and hang out, because it's like a big community really, and I think everyone that's done it knows they've shared in something special.
So, tell us again, when does it start and where in the British Isles can we see them?
Matt, can you remind us again?
30th of August, somewhere in the south of England to be announced. So we don't know yet, but it doesn't really matter. We'll be there with bells on, ready to go. We come back through Derry, Londonderry. We actually arrived during the sailing festival, so the whole place is sailing mad. So we're just another part of another big piece. So I think it's going to be a quite an experience, and obviously some great Northern Irish hospitality.
So there you go. That's definitely one to keep an eye on over the next 18 months. We'll maybe catch up with Matt again before he heads out, and hopefully when he gets back. He has been in touch by email, by the way, to say that he is undertaking the whole journey. Fair play to him.
Are you tempted to do it?
Well, I mean, it sounds amazing, but frankly, I don't like the water, and we don't have the money either. It can be expensive. We were told it costs about £5,000 per leg. So I think either you have to be dedicated, you really have to want to do it. But it does seem to attract a lot of people who have retired. So they've made their money and are looking for a bit of adventure. And good luck to them.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this week. Join us again next week. I'm heading to the theatre and we are both going to the cinema. See you then.
Cheers for now.